told me later that, in Holland, every kid dreams of playing for Man United. He knew I had been to see him when he was 16. Arsenal beat us to him when he was emerging as a star at Feyenoord, but he stressed what a dream it was for Dutch kids to wear the United crest. He was impressed with the youth of our team. We had gigs and schools, but we also had Chicharito and the two Da Silvas, Evans, Jones and Smalling, Welbeck. Carrick, at 31, was having his best ever season for us. It dawns on some players, when they perform at their best, just how important they are to the team, and in turn it makes them grow, as it did with Carrick. Robin knew he was coming to a settled club. City had been terrific the previous season, but you would not call them a settled organisation. There was always an issue with someone setting off fireworks or falling out with the manager. Tevez wanted to play golf in Argentina. City had won the league largely through the efforts of four top performers: Yaya Toure, Sergio Aguero, Vincent Kompany and Joe Hart. Plus David Silva for the first half of the season, though he trailed away somewhat after Christmas. I say this all the time about strikers. Cantona, Andy Cole. If they're not scoring, they think they're never going to score again. In his brief dry spell in the March of that season, Van Persie wasn't playing as well, and it affected him. But from the minute he scored against Stoke on the 14th of April, he was on fire again. Over the years, I witnessed some immortal Manchester United goals. Cantona treated the crowd to two or three wonderful chipped finishes. Rooney's bicycle kick against City took some beating. The execution was incredible. It's not as if that unforgettable overhead finish was delivered from the 6-yard line. He was 14 yards from goal. It also took a deflection as he was running in. Nani's cross veered off a City player, so Wayne was forced to make an amazing mid-air adjustment. That was the best one, for my money. But Van Persie's against Aston Villa in the 3-0 win that secured us the title on the 22nd of April was special too. An over-the-shoulder volley from a long drilled ball by Rooney. A normal player would try that trick 100 times in training and score once. Van Persie could do it regularly. Shoulder down, head down, eyes down, through the ball. The same mastery of technique brought him a goal of similar quality for Arsenal against Everton. He was a wonderful signing who finished the season with 26 league goals, 12 at home and 14 away. He struck 17 times with his left foot and 8 with his right, plus one from a header. Those figures earned him the Golden Boot, awarded to the Premier League's top scorer for the second consecutive year. At the other end of the age scale, we continued to place our faith in youth. Nick Powell, who joined in July 2012, had been in our sights since November 2011. Crew brought him into their team at outside left when he was 17 and still a bit gangly. Our academy staff had drawn a ring round his name and we scouted for him regularly. Jim Lawler went to look at him and said he was interesting, though he was not sure what his best position would be and thought he might be a wee bit laid back. So I sent out Martin to watch him twice. Martin's view was that he definitely had something, but was not the full package yet. Then McPhelan went to examine him in a couple of fixtures. Finally, it was my turn. Crew versus Aldershot. After 5 minutes in the stands, I told Mick, "He's a player, Mick. He's a player." It was his touch in the ball and his vision. At one point in the game, I saw he got a half run in the opposition's defence. He had a wee look over his shoulder and just lofted the ball to the centre forward to have a shot and goal. Then he showed us a header, then a turn of pace. "Coming away," I said to Mick, "I'm going to phone Dario Grady, now director of football at Crewe."
"I see you were at the game yesterday," said Dario.
"The boy Powell," I said. "Now don't get carried away. What's your ballpark figure?" Dario said,
6 million.
Laughing, I told him where to go. But we constructed a potential deal in that direction with add-ons for first team and England appearances. Powell was not told until after that season's playoffs. He's an absolute certainty to be in the England team one day. He could play anywhere, off the front, even through. He's quick as hell, has two good feet and shoots from outside the box. In the winter of 2012, he picked up a virus and his girlfriend had a nasty car accident. He's quite a detached figure, good at switching off, but he's a player, believe me. Shinji Kagawa was another good catch that summer. We elected not to move for him after his first season in German football, because sometimes a player rises a notch and you want to be sure he can sustain it. He played in a very good Dortmund team, which I considered capable of winning the 2013 Champions League. In the event, they reached the final but lost to Bayern Munich. The first thing I noticed was Shinji's sharp football brain. Mick and I flew to Berlin for the German Cup final in the summer of 2012, and I found myself sitting next to the mayor of Dortmund and his wife. He was wearing trainers. Angela Merkel was nearby, along with Joachim Löw, the German coach. Introduced to Mrs. Merkel, the German Chancellor, I thought to myself, my word, I've come a long way. There was no way I could hide in that seat, but everyone knew I was going anyway. That summer the Glazers were perfectly happy to go for Van Persie or Robert Lewandowski or Kagawa. In many of our greatest phases, we could call in four fantastic strikers. Making sure they all felt valued could be problematic. It required a range of diplomatic skills. Dortmund, however, refused to sell Lewandowski, who has a wonderful physique and has good lines of running. The other signing was Alexander Büttner from Dutch club Vitesse Arnhem. We had allowed Fabio to go to Queen's Park Rangers on loan, and we had a couple of young left-backs with potential, but we needed experience in that area and backup for Evra. Büttner was flagged up. He was always taking the ball, having shots, taking on defenders, a bargain at 2.5 million euros. He was an aggressive boy, determined, quickish, and a good crosser of the ball. There were times in the first half of that season when we couldn't have defended a sandcastle. We conceded way too many times for my liking before tightening up from January onwards. The goalkeeping position was complicated. De Gea developed a tooth infection and needed an operation to remove his two rear molars. He missed a couple of games on that account, and Anders Lindegaard didn't do anything wrong in the number one spot. He had a good game at Galatasaray and against West Ham. My message to De Gea was that I needed to be fair to Anders. But after our narrow 4-3 win at Reading on the 1st of December, De Gea came back in and did well throughout the second half of the season, especially in the 1-1 draw at Real Madrid in February, where he was brilliant. I still had high hopes for Javier Hernandez. The issue with Chicharito was freshness. For three seasons in a row, he played all summer with his country. Despite that, we cooperated well with Mexico. The presidents of their FA and Olympic Association came over with their coaches for a meeting with me. I showed them the medical file. Under discussion was whether he could play in two World Cup qualifiers as well as the Olympics. Chicharito said, I'd rather miss the other two games and play in the Olympics because I think we'll win it. I thought he was joking. He went on, if we don't get Brazil in the quarterfinals, we'll win it. Meanwhile, we had invested heavily in a marvellous new medical centre for Carrington. We can now do everything on site, apart from operations. We had a chiropodist, dentist, scanners, everything. The benefit was that, apart from having it all on site, injuries would not become instant public knowledge. In the past, we might send a player to hospital and rumours would flash round the city. This told you we weren't standing still. It might have been one of our best buys. A major incident from that season requires a mention. The allegation, later dismissed by the authorities, that referee Mark Clattenburg had used racist language against Chelsea players in our 3-2 victory at Stamford Bridge on the 28th of October. A word about the game first. Against Di Matteo's Chelsea, we needed to work out how we would operate against Juan Mata, Oscar and Eden Hazard. Those three were hammering teams and turning on the style. The two sitting midfielders, Ramirez and Mikel, were bombing on. We elected to load the right side to attack the areas they had vacated by attacking us and squeeze Mata's space. It was a thrilling game until the shenanigans at the end of the match. When Fernando Torres was sent off, Steve Holland, one of Di Matteo's assistants, blamed me. I looked at him, bemused. Mike Dean, the fourth official, could make no sense of Holland's accusation. Torres should already have been sent off in the first half for a tackle uncleverly. When Hernandez scored the winning goal, half a seat came on and hit Carrick in the foot, along with lighters and coins. I still wonder whether the Clattenburg allegation was a smokescreen to obscure the crowd trouble. 20 minutes after the game, I went in with my staff for a drink, and in that wee room were Bruce Buck, the Chelsea chairman, Ron Gourlay, the chief executive, Di Matteo and his wife. You could sense an atmosphere. Something wasn't right. We stood in the doorway and thought it wise to leave them to it. The food was covered and the wine was uncorked. They said, "Help yourselves," and left the room. My own staff had seen Mikel fly into the referee's room with John Terry and Di Matteo. Whoever told Mikel that Clattenburg had said something inflammatory was making a big call. It was also a big move by Chelsea to inform the press pretty much straight away that an alleged incident had been reported. A lawyer might have sat back and said, "Let's wait until tomorrow." The Branislav Ivanovic sending off in that game was perfectly straightforward. Torres went down easily, but Evans did catch him. When you see where Clattenburg was, you can see why he sent him off for simulation. He took one step, then went down. A toe is enough to fell a player moving at speed, but Torres did go over softly. I've no idea why Holland thought I had forced Clattenburg to send him off. A few days later, Di Matteo announced that I had too much power with referees. I had run-ins with match officials all my life. I was sent off 8 times as a player. I was sent to the stands 3 or 4 times as a manager in Scotland. I was fined so many times in England. I always had disputes of one sort or another. But I called it as I saw it. I never went out of my way to drop a referee in the soup. There is no way in my mind that a top referee would be racist to a player. I called Mark Clattenburg and said, "I'm just sorry we are the other team involved in this." I was poised for someone in authority to bring us into the inquiry, which fortunately never happened. I had no knowledge of it until we boarded the plane back to Manchester. The FA took a hell of a long time to reach the decision that Mark was innocent. It could have been concluded in 2 days. From January 2013, we really motored on in the league, piling pressure on Man City all the way. For me, knowing I was standing down, the sense of release and relief was delayed until the night we beat Aston Villa to win the title. We were going to win it anyway, but to finish the job in April on our own ground was immensely comforting. I would go out with a bang. I continued to make my team talks and prepare for games properly. The professionalism of Manchester United remained intact. The only disappointment, of course, was losing our Champions League round of 16 tie to Real Madrid in a game that featured a ludicrous sending off for Nani by Tuneyt Çakır, the Turkish referee, for an innocuous challenge. In Spain, in the first leg, we had been terrific, weathering a 20-minute storm at the start of the match. We could have won by 6. I held no fear of facing Jose Mourinho's team again at home. Our preparation was perfect. We devised a good plan for the game. Our energy was terrific, and we forced 3 or 4 great saves from their goalkeeper. David De Gea barely made a stop. Nani was sent off in the 56th minute for leaping to meet the ball and making slight contact with Alvaro Arbeloa. And for 10 minutes we were up against it. We were in shock. On came Modric for Real to equalise Sergio Ramos's own goal, and then Ronaldo finished us in the 69th minute. But we might have scored 5 in the last 10 minutes. It was an absolute disaster. I was particularly upset that night and gave the post-match press conference a miss. If we had beaten Real Madrid, there would have been every reason to imagine we could win the competition. I left Wayne out of that second leg because we needed someone to get on top of Alonso and play off him. The Jisung Park of early years would have been perfect for that job. Andrea Pirlo's passing rate for Milan had been 75%. When we played them with Jisung Park in the holding role, we reduced Pirlo's strike rate to 25%. There was no better player in our squad to keep on top of Alonso than Danny Welbeck. Yes, we sacrificed Wayne's possible goal scoring, but we knew we had to choke Alonso and exploit that gain. Ronaldo was wonderful in those 2 games. In the Madrid leg, he made his way into our dressing room to sit with our players. You could tell he missed them. After the Old Trafford game, as I was watching the video of the sending off, he came in to sympathise. The Real players knew the sending off had been absurd. Mesut Ozil confessed to one of our players that Jose's team felt they had got out of jail. Cristiano declined to celebrate his goal, which is just as well, because I would have strangled him. There were no issues with him at all. He's a very nice boy. My final thought on Man City losing the title to us was that they couldn't call on enough players who understood the significance of what they had achieved by winning the league for the first time for 44 years. Evidently, it was enough for some of them to have beaten Manchester United in a title race. they settled down into a sense of relief. Retaining a title is the next hard step, and City were not in the right state of mind to defend what they had won on the most dramatic closing day in Premier League history. When I won the league for the first time in 1993, I didn't want my team to slacken off. The thought appalled me. I was determined to keep advancing, to strengthen our hold on power. I told that 1993 side, "Some people, when they have a holiday, just want to go to Solcoats, 25 miles along the coast from Glasgow. Some people don't even want to do that. They're happy to stay at home or watch the birds and the ducks float by in the park. And some want to go to the moon. It's about people's ambitions."
26. Looking back, moving forward. Towards the end of the first year of my retirement, I found myself facing a group of high-flying students at the Harvard Business School. After 4 decades of addressing football teams in changing rooms, I was out of my comfort zone, but excited to be talking to a completely different audience about management. You can imagine how proud I was to be part of such a prestigious academic institution. For me, it was a tremendous challenge. In a room full of such talented people, you need to have your wits about you and think clearly about the messages you convey. In my work at Harvard, I started out with a big bag of material, but soon realised I had to identify the elements that are most important in terms of successful leadership. These include work ethic, determination, decision-making, observation. All these apply to anyone in a leadership position, and I've been able to use a lot of my experiences in football to help students understand the game they're in. Talking and taking questions has also helped me understand my own time in management. In the thick of the job, I was never one for looking back. Now I do it often. What shines in the memory is what great players I had. I can hardly believe there were so many. One obvious aspect of management is identifying people who can help you get where you're trying to go. Talent identification sounds like a straightforward business. If it were, every team would be successful. My first trip to Boston was in September, 4 months after I stood down as United manager. I met the president of Harvard, Drew Faust, about assuming a more clearly defined role at the school, and was delighted to be appointed as a fellow to the Executive Education Programme. This position covers a wide spectrum of activities and allows Harvard to attach me to the courses and classes best suited to my knowledge and experience. It's a fantastic opportunity at this stage of my life. The highlight of a summer that included holidays, family time and a hip operation was a cruise round the Hebrides. I was joined by my sons, my brother Martin, my brother-in-law John and some close friends. Before we set off, we made the skipper wait until Andy Murray had secured the Wimbledon men's singles title with that dramatic victory. As soon as he won the final point, we opened the champagne and set sail from Oban. At 71 years old, I was a touch ashamed that this was the first time I was setting foot in this part of the world. But it was one of the most enjoyable trips I have experienced. We visited Iona, Skye and Tobermory on Mull. Fingal's Cave on Staffa was incredible. I couldn't wait to visit Iona, as the history of the Abbey is steeped in Govan history. You have to go back to the 30s in Glasgow to take up the story of Govan's involvement. George MacLeod of Funery became moderator of the General Assembly of the Church of Scotland, and he followed his father and grandfather in that prestigious position. Before he succeeded to that lofty position, he was the minister of the Govan Parish Church, and his influence still exists to this day. In the 30s, Iona Abbey was almost a ruin and needed emergency repairs to bring it back to its original state. George, with all his energy and persuasive tongue, managed to bring a group of workers from Fairfield Shipyard in Govan to carry out the work to restore this great monastery. So you can imagine my excitement at visiting Iona for the first time in my life, and I wasn't disappointed. It was exhilarating. And I honestly felt that with my Govan connection, I had a part to play in all of it. Such was my pride in the efforts of these shipyard workers. In the mornings, I would sit on the deck to take in the stunning scenery. As we sailed during the day, encountering all sorts of wildlife, I was saying to myself, why have I not done this before? One night I was a victim of a wind-up when I was asked to go to see the skipper, which I always enjoyed, as he had a million tales from his 40 years at sea. But this particular visit was a set-up. While I was chatting away to him, my friends were downstairs changing into pirate outfits. On my return below deck, I was met by a motley crew wearing wigs and eye patches, roaring at me and waving plastic swords. I almost had a bloody heart attack. The next morning, we disembarked the boat at the Noidart Peninsula and were told, "There are no mobile phone signals on this island. Please let someone know where you are." In fact, for most of our journey, there was no mobile signal. It was the ideal antidote to the emotion surrounding my retirement. At the local pub, we sat outside in the sun with no hassle. Nobody knew who the hell I was. It was perfect. My book launch evolved into a theatre tour, which took in stops in Manchester, London, Glasgow, Aberdeen and Dublin, as well as Kirkham Grammar School in Preston. I enjoyed being interviewed at these events, looking back over my time in football, and the enthusiastic reaction of the fans was much appreciated. At a signing session at Tesco Extra in Stretford, people queued for 6 hours for an autograph. The day before, I had been on my way to Old Trafford for the Real Sociedad game, when I'd been told there was a woman who had been there since the morning, determined to be first in the queue. I called in on the way to the match to thank her and present her with the first signed book. I was amazed at the turnout, and was happy to extend my time there by several hours to repay the support. At the start of the year, we went to Barbados for a week to celebrate a friend's 50th birthday. That was wonderful. We were the beneficiaries of Wigan Athletic owner Dave Whelan's generosity, and stayed at his magnificent house. The party at the Lone Star restaurant started at 12 midday, and, for some, finished at 4 the next morning. The Oscars were another enjoyable stop. On the Friday night, we attended the British Embassy party and met Philomena Lee, a wonderful lady and the subject of a film about her 50-year search for her son. An added attraction was that around 10 employees of the British consulate were Scottish, which pleased me. At another party, the night before the Oscars, we met Lupita Nyong'o, the young actress from 12 Years a Slave, and her brother, who is a big Manchester United fan. I also enjoyed talking to Serena Williams. The highlight was probably meeting Reese Witherspoon. Her Scottish ancestor, John Witherspoon, had, from 1768, been the 6th president of the College of New Jersey, later Princeton University, another Scottish contribution to American history. My friend, Martin O'Connor, had somehow secured tickets for Cathy and me for the awards ceremony, which was spectacular and hugely enjoyable. This trip was high on my wish list, and it didn't disappoint. The Vanity Fair party after the main event was the big one, a who's who of Hollywood. There I was introduced to many actors and actresses, including Samuel L. Jackson, who was great company and very funny. It was not my normal world, but a fascinating experience for film buffs such as Cathy and me. We are regular cinema goers, and the whole trip was exhilarating. The shape of my life was changing in all sorts of ways. The hip surgery delayed my return to the club as a spectator and director. When I finally took my seat in the director's box, the fans were noticeably intrigued. At first, I confess, I was a little bit disorientated. I had been United manager for the best part of 27 years, and now I was in a director's seat, with fans asking me for autographs. This new position felt strange at first. The supporters looked at me with a penetrating curiosity. My guess was that they were trying to read my thoughts, and of course they were not used to seeing me so high in the stands in a non-combatant role. For my first game back, I had 4 of my grandchildren with me, as well as my daughter-in-law, Tanya, and my brother-in-law, John. I betrayed no emotion, but I was often like that as a manager too, particularly towards the end. It was the correct way to behave in the director's box. In my early years at Old Trafford, I was much more emotional. But for a large chunk of my career, I was impassive, unless I was required to be more assertive. I was still part of Manchester United as a director and ambassador, but the football side of me was really kept active through my appointment as an ambassador to UEFA. They wanted me to chair their coaching seminars, and I was delighted to say yes. My first manager's conference was by video link from Old Trafford, which felt odd. It was as if I were speaking from another planet. But they felt it went well. My first taste of UEFA seminars was in Budapest, at a conference of 200 coaches, where I made a speech and took questions. I tried to guide them down the road of doing well. First, you have to have a love for and a commitment to football. There's a great deal of sacrifice involved, but the reward is the satisfaction you feel when the results work out, especially the development of young players. We are all in it for that. In Turin and Lisbon, I took coaches' meetings in which we discussed tactics, the way the game is played now. There have been numerous changes over the last few years, particularly as regards counter-attacking. If you go back and study counter-attacking, teams would strike with one or two runners, particularly in Latin American countries. Now they flood forwards, five or six at a time. Another change is the state of the pitches, which are outstanding and add quality to the spectacle. I enjoy these meetings. It's important to me that I share my knowledge and pass on the benefits of my experience. Young managers need advice and guidance about the industry they're moving into. It's not an easy one, and it's getting harder. Premier League managers go down like flies. Young managers need to find a formula for communicating with the owners and chief executives. That part is more important than ever, because you are dealing with a different type of owner now. At no point should you surrender your beliefs or your control, but you need a way of communicating. In the Premier League, you could find yourself answering to an owner from America, Russia, the Middle East or Malaysia. The model I represented has passed into history. You won't see anyone manage one club for 26 years. I must say, though, that Arsene Wenger's reign at Arsenal deserves a special mention. Everyone was happy for him winning the FA Cup. I was hoping Steve Bruce would win it for Hull because he was one of my players. But you also had to have a special feeling for Arsene, given the pressure he was under for not winning a trophy for 9 years. Arsene has always been dogged and determined about his beliefs, and has never succumbed to pressure to change. The standard and the method have been consistent. He has always been good at acquiring and developing young players. He is never afraid to play young people, which is bold, because young players are not fully formed. Who is to say that Arsene will not beat my record? I have my doubts, but he's having a good crack at it. Brendan Rodgers, the Liverpool manager, was another interesting case. Before the 2013-14 league season kicked off, my top three were United, Chelsea and Manchester City. However, Liverpool's form was amazing, brilliant, and they made their leap forward the right way. They played positive football. Even a United fan, seeing them as the nemesis, couldn't begrudge Liverpool their surge up the table. From my perspective, they were definitely the team of the year. Daniel Sturridge made a vital difference, and Raheem Sterling developed in a different role to the one he'd started with, that of a winger. When they stuck Sterling in off the front, behind the striker, the results were startling. Everyone expected Luis Suarez to be the prolific player he was. He stayed at the level of the previous year. Sterling and Sturridge added the extra potency. Another factor was Steven Gerrard playing in front of the back four, a tactic no other Liverpool manager had adopted. Gerrard thrived on that and had a fantastic season. Tony Pulis called and asked for my advice about taking the Crystal Palace job when it looked like a doomed relegation battle. I pointed out to Tony that it would be possible to make Palace hard to beat on their own ground, where they attract fanatical support. That would be one card in his favour. They have a bonkers kind of energy at Selhurst Park. Tony knew himself from his time at Stoke that developing some form by the turn of the year could lead to dramatic improvement in the final 5 months, even from bottom of the league. He joined Palace when they had 7 points from 12 matches, and they finished up with 45, which is astounding. I thought Tony, who left Palace in August, shortly before the 2014-15 campaign kicked off, was the manager of the year. Brendan Rodgers was voted manager of the year, with Tony the Premier League manager of the season. I would guess this was because Tony's work was done in the second half of the season. Either way, both these managers excelled. There were some impressive performances by other coaches. Sean Dyche at Burnley, for example. Sean called me a few times for chats. We had a small squad. Well, you could pray, I told him. More seriously, I said, keep telling everyone how much energy the players have, and eventually the squad will believe it themselves. Energy can be a psychological factor as well as a physical one. I was so pleased it went well for him. It was interesting being on the sidelines and watching the league take shape. I had been convinced Chelsea would win it. In February through to the beginning of March, I was certain they would come through. The Jose Mourinho factor played on my mind. He kept calling his team underdogs, or rather, the little horse, and grew more entertaining as the season wore on. You couldn't take your eyes off his press conferences. Even I, despite knowing him, could never be sure whether he was being mischievous or serious. He has this knack of confusing people. When City were knocked out of the Champions League, I thought they would come with a run, domestically. But sometimes reaching the final of the League Cup can sap you at the wrong time. No one thought Liverpool could win the league for the first time since 1990, until the beginning of April, when they were on that terrific run of 11 wins in a row before their home defeat by Chelsea. Manuel Pellegrini, the City manager, was familiar to me from his time at Malaga, and I was pleased for him as a colleague. There was no question that City possessed the best group of players, though the fact that they have twice won the league so narrowly leaves a question mark. Why is that? Yes, they lost Sergio Aguero and Vincent Kompany at various points, but they had a big squad, and it was a surprise that City were unable to pull away. The tactical change in Chelsea's play was noticeable. They came to Old Trafford on 26th of August and played with no strikers. I was surprised by that. Maybe Jose didn't quite trust his goal scorers and didn't feel he was sending out his own team. He can be pragmatic and place not wanting to lose above all other considerations. At Liverpool, he played an unfamiliar back four of Cesar Azpilicueta, Tomas Kalas, Branislav Ivanovic and Ashley Cole, and to draw that performance from them was amazing. After 10 minutes, I thought, Chelsea are going to win this. Suarez was very subdued. There wasn't the usual spark about him. The way Chelsea were set up pointed to an upset. I called Sam Allardyce at West Ham a few times. Sam was taking stick from the fans at Upton Park. I hope that before I die, someone can explain the West Ham way. What is it? They last won a trophy in 1980, the FA Cup. I never played against any West Ham team that played football I was afraid of. They were always surviving, or lucky as hell against us. In May 1995, they killed our hopes of winning the title with a 1-1 draw that was a siege. They never came out of their box. So what is this West Ham way? I had to sympathise with Sam. He couldn't win. There is this preconception with West Ham fans that Big Sam is a survivalist who tells teams to boot the ball up the pitch. The truth is that he stayed up with a team of very average players. That's management. He drew the best from them. I was not about to turn my back on my old sparring partners just because I was occupied in other areas of my life. In fact, the Harvard Business School activity showed me how it all connects. Those students and academics helped me keep sharp. My new role at Harvard began in the spring of 2014, when I attended a meeting with 7 faculty professors from the Organisational Behaviour and Leadership departments. They wanted to quiz me on my experiences and philosophies, and assess how I might contribute from then on. The session was marvellous. They left me feeling welcome and valued. The next session was with young executives, who were signed up for an 8-week advanced business management course. I was interviewed by Professor Anita Elbers in front of 68 people from 45 countries, and again, it went well. My final appearance, apart from a variety of meetings with key individuals, was supporting a new programme, The Business of Entertainment, Media and Sports. The class was built around the earlier case study into my managerial career. For the first hour, I sat with the participants as they discussed the case study. Then there was a break, followed by 80 minutes with me in the middle of the room on the end of their questions. During the first half of the session, a diagram appeared on the blackboard with players, staff, media, chief executive and so on, all connected to me in the centre. I worked my way through each relationship, covering all the elements that were part of my world as manager of Manchester United. Duster in hand, I rubbed out most of them, and told the audience, these ultimately don't matter. The press, one press conference a week, an interview after the game. Agents, you tend to hear from them when a player wants money, and so on, until it came down to the core of the job. Your players, your staff, and your chief executive, because you deal with them every day. The rest you deal with as they come along. My decision to delegate more in my later years also strikes me now as a wise move, well-timed. It allowed me to enjoy my last decade and to pursue the thing that mattered, results on the pitch. It's that point about understanding where your energy comes from. When I was younger, I could go out the night before and be up for training at 6 a.m. But as you grow older, that becomes impractical. You have to use your energy differently and understand that change. The food you eat, the sleep you get. Natural energy is a great asset, but even that starts to subside. You get old. I'm not saying I felt old, but the fact is that I was in my 60s and 70s for my last decade at the club. All my focus was on keeping the right level of control over the football club and keeping the winning mentality. By delegating, I was able to help that process. And I was open to ideas, because I knew we were in a different world. We were no longer in a world with mud up the centre of the pitch. There were no more toe-capped boots. The players were wearing slippers. Most of it was progress. Not all, but most. I never allowed the press to dominate me. I didn't expend energy on media relations. Some modern managers burn energy thinking they have to give the press something. My philosophy was, Manchester United should never be afraid of the press. Yes, we had to communicate, but not every minute, on every story, every player. There had to be a protective shield around a lot of it. There might have been an injury we needed to keep to ourselves. Why should you help your opponents? I was able to control that part quite well and keep my energy for the right things. Commercial activity, even dinners, take a lot of your time and energy, and I became more selective with these activities towards the end of my career. The job always came first for me. Not only was I lucky with the players, I was lucky with my staff. There were a lot of people who worked with me for over 20 years. They formed an invaluable support system, and they deserve my eternal gratitude. But, having moved on to the next stage of my life, my sense that I could offer something outside of football was proving correct. I wasn't going to let retirement dampen my curiosity, or my spirits. 27. United in transition. Even the best laid plans take unexpected turns. No football manager has the world entirely at his feet. We are all members of a trade where circumstances can suddenly change out of all recognition. The important part is that we keep our pride intact and begin afresh. New opportunities will come along. Losing a big job in football management is no barrier to future success. When David Moyes left Manchester United in April 2014, I was in no doubt that he would pick up the thread of a fine career. More than that, to have United on your CV is a mark of esteem, proof of your talent. It was sad that David lost his job after less than a year in charge, but countless managers, including myself, have achieved good things in the game after being sacked. One of the best recent examples I can think of is Carlo Ancelotti. After leaving Chelsea, he went on to win the French League with PSG and ended the 2013-14 season at Real Madrid as a Champions League winner. You can't look upon dismissal as the end of your football life. David Moyes still has plenty going for him. On his record, it will show that he was selected to be manager of Manchester United, which is a rare occurrence. My mind turns, for example, to how well Ron Atkinson fared after losing the United job. Your professional life is not ended the minute you part company with a club, no matter how prestigious. David will go on to do really well in his working life. It's important to say that, regarding the appointment of my successor, a clear process was followed. Surely people don't really believe the Glazer family would allow the new manager to be chosen by one person. During the meeting with the Glazers in New York after my decision to stand down, we began the process of selecting a new manager as any major institution would. We identified the best candidates, established their availability, and continued the process. There appears to be an accepted view out there that there was no process. Nonsense. This stems from the fact that not one iota of what we were thinking crept out to the press. It was contained discreetly within the four walls of the football club. With confidentiality uppermost, there was no external pressure. When we made the announcement, no one knew it was coming. Conversely, the news of my retirement had leaked the day before it was officially announced, and complicated the issue of me telling my players and staff. With David's appointment, we feel we did everything the right way. Quietly, thoroughly, professionally. At the end of this methodical procedure, David Moyes was appointed as manager of Manchester United. The board worked in harmony throughout. We were very excited to get him, and at the time the majority of the press agreed that this was a great appointment, in line with the club's traditions and values. In 11 seasons at Everton, David had been hard-working and displayed great integrity. True, he had not won a trophy during that long reign, a fact that was always used against him, but that detail was misleading. He was the leader at a club which, in many ways, was not set up to win trophies, both financially and in terms of the stadium size. So David overcame many handicaps and hurdles to produce good Everton sides and achieve good results along the way. During our initial conversations about staffing, David indicated that he would bring two people with him, maybe three. David had already told me that he was going to be taking the coaching himself, which left no real role for Rennie Meulensteen. I suggested he should keep Mick Phelan, who would have been a great help. Mick knew the club, could guide David, and was loyal, 100% United. There was no slight against Mick and David's decision not to keep him. It was just that he wanted his own people around him. Maybe David felt that at such a massive club, he had to be sure all corners of the club were covered in terms of his support system. I felt that network was already there, with plenty of great people already in important slots. David was not alone in preferring to have his own group to call on. You see it time and again. Managers these days often arrive at clubs with six or seven staff. That's the modern way in football. Those personnel changes were not the reason it didn't work out for him. Moving from Everton to Manchester United was a massive jump, as he acknowledged himself in his press conferences. He was honest and open from the start. He hadn't realised just how big United is as a club. For 26 years, everyone had been accustomed to seeing me walk into that training ground every morning. To adapt to a manager with different methods and a new philosophy required a culture shift. A change of that magnitude would affect the running of any operation in any business. David talked a lot about change and how long it would take to implement. It is natural for a new manager to want to imprint his ideas on a squad. It's such a hard balance to strike, however, because the press and public want to hear big ideas, big plans. The fixture list was cruel to him. His first home game was against Chelsea on the 26th of August, a 0-0 draw. His second away game the following Sunday was at Liverpool, where we lost 1-0. He went to Manchester City for our fifth Premier League fixture and lost 4-1. A debate was soon whipped up about my presence at games, as if I were going to cast a shadow over David's efforts. Everyone knew that when I retired I would become a director and ambassador. Nobody said at that time, "This will be a problem for a new manager." The manager sits in the dugout, not in the stands, so I don't see how anyone could have seen me as being anywhere near the front line. I had emphasised in numerous interviews that my time in charge was over. There was no ambivalence in my decision to stand down. I was ready to move on and try new things in my life. So there was no possibility of the players, in a lean spell, looking up to the director's box and thinking, "Boss, what shall we do here?" As I was never the media's best friend, there was always going to be fresh scrutiny from their end of the industry. I even saw a suggestion that United were moving away from an antiquated system where one man ran everything. I spoke earlier in these memoirs about the importance of delegation as Manchester United grew to a size that required a spreading of responsibility. Particularly in my last decade, delegation became a vital tool that contributed to our success. Antiquated was a bizarre description of the structure I left behind at Manchester United. Have you seen our new training ground? In 2000 we moved from the Cliff to Carrington, a training ground fit for a team at the pinnacle of the game. But times change, and you have to change with them. The development of Carrington, 2 years ago, gives us a base with medical facilities and a sports science set-up that provides everything a football club could need. Our training complex is one of the things I'm most proud of from my time at Manchester United. As the new arrangement settled down, I retained a respectful distance, as any ex-manager should do. Carrington, I considered, out of bounds. There was no urge on my part to visit my old workplace. Nor did I enter the dressing room, which is normal for directors after matches. At the same time, was I meant to disappear? I was a director of the club. I want to watch and support Manchester United, and David was never troubled by my presence at games. He was glad to see me there. The idea that it might add to the pressure on him came from the press and public. They invented a problem that never existed. A Manchester United manager has to have a strong character and broad shoulders. He has to handle a million things. But nobody ever saw me shouting or leaping from my seat. I was fully attuned to my new role. Any time David phoned me, I was there to help him. I wanted him to succeed. In my leaving speech in the Old Trafford pitch, I told fans it was important to get behind the new manager. I was keen for him to do well and gave him advice as much as I was able when I was asked. After the Man City game at home, we had a good chat. It was just David and me. Private. No one else was privy to the discussions we had. As the results deteriorated, each defeat was a hammer blow to him. I could see that in his demeanour. In January, we bought Juan Mata, and that gave everyone a lift. But I could see the walls squeezing in, leaving David with less and less room to breathe. I know that feeling from 1989, when we went through a terrible spell. You feel you're being crushed. The results, however, gnawed away at David. We were knocked out of the FA Cup by Swansea at home on 5th of January, and later lost a Capital One Cup semi-final to Sunderland. I had hoped the League Cup would provide David with his breakthrough. The pace of play slowed down a touch, I could see that. But every manager has his preferred style. The reason for playing at speed was that United players had been accustomed to operating that way. If the tempo slowed for any reason, I would be into them at half-time. "This is not us," I would say. We had phenomenal athletes who could run, who were quick, with good balance. Playing with speed never hindered our results. It was our way. Energy and determination in the last third of the pitch. These were expressions of me, my nature. Allied with superior skill, it produced a potent combination. Though I upheld those aims throughout my career, I was never religious about that style of play. At no stage did I think it was the only way to operate, or that anyone who deviated from speed and dynamism was a heathen. We encountered many tactical systems, and I respected them all, unless they were based on good teams taking a negative approach. But results kept undermining David's work. Olympiacos away on 25th of February was another setback, because the team played poorly in a 2-0 defeat, subsequently avenged by a 3-0 home win. That recovery earned us a tie with Bayern Munich, who beat us 3-1 in Germany after a 1-1 draw at Old Trafford. In Munich, Patrice Evra scored a wonderful goal in the 57th minute, and suddenly the victory was on. But Bayern Munich struck back within 2 minutes through Mario Mandzukic, and then Thomas Müller and Iron Robin finished the job. That was a body blow. Bayern Munich weren't playing particularly well at that time. At Old Trafford, they claimed a lot of possession, but we had the best unconverted chance when Danny Welbeck was through on the keeper, but failed to score. In March, our form dived even further, with 3-0 home defeats by both Liverpool and Manchester City. In the first half against Liverpool, I felt we were level pegging in terms of chances created, but Liverpool were awarded the first of 3 penalty kicks after 34 minutes, and that changed the game. In the second half, when they went 2-0 up, Liverpool really showed their form and might have battered us. It's hard to watch that kind of outcome when Liverpool are the ones dishing out the pain. It was a rough season for a United fan, and it was tough for me, because I knew there were plenty of good players in our squad. They weren't showing their form, and that seemed to place a huge weight on David's shoulders. Ultimately, it was the momentum of results that hastened his downfall. Nobody could dispute how disappointing the season was, and it cost a man his job. After the 2-0 defeat at Everton on the 20th of April, the Glazers took the view that they had to make a decision. This is my chance to clear up a few misconceptions. Did players come to see me to complain? Did they, hell? Utter nonsense. Rio Ferdinand paid me a visit to ask my advice on his future. Patrice Evra's contract was up and he was also unsure about his future. I told him to look forward to the World Cup and think about it later. Neither discussed the team or team affairs with me. I would have had no interest in talking about the Man United team with David's players. They were his, not mine. Whilst the press searched for reasons behind the dip in form, the make-up of the squad was mentioned. There appeared to be a consensus of opinion that the group was too old. Again, nonsense. A squad that won the championship by 11 points included the following players, all aged 25 or under. Evans, De Gea, Jones, Smalling, Hernandez, Cleverley, Kagawa, Raphael and Welbeck. All international players, all league champions. We also had Lingard, Powell. Ferdinand, Evra, Vidic, Carrick, Giggs and Scholes were all in their 30s. Chelsea started the current season as favourites for the title, with a squad that also had 6 players in their 30s. I don't hear any grumbles about the age of their group. It is viewed, as it should be, that having that level of experience in your squad, bolstered by the energy of youth, creates a powerful combination. Gone are the days when a 32-year-old player is looking to hang his boots up. The development of sports science and the improvement in pitches are amongst the reasons why the modern player can play into his late 30s. The performances from Wes Brown and John O'Shea for Sunderland in the final third of last season demonstrated the importance of experience. Liverpool have just bought Ricky Lambert at 32. Why would they do this unless they knew he could perform at that level moving into his mid-30s? The story that I was abused by Man United fans at one home game was also completely wrong. I neither saw nor heard any dissent directed at me. I didn't come across any hostility. The claim was checked with people sitting behind and in front of me, and nobody reported hearing anything. Nobody could substantiate the reports. I wouldn't ever expect to be abused by Manchester United fans. When David's dismissal came about, I was in Aberdeen as the events unfolded. It was suggested in the media that there was a hurried meeting in a hotel on the Sunday night after the Everton defeat, prior to David being sacked. I would like to know which hotel, because I wasn't there. Nor were Bobby Charlton, David Gill, or Mike Edelson, fellow directors. On the Monday, I was flying back to Manchester, and sitting next to me was a lad with a newspaper with a headline that ran, "David Moyes to be sacked." At the same time, David Moyes texted me. I wasn't sure what to say to him, because I was unsure what was happening at that exact moment. Ed Woodward had recently spoken to the directors to update us on the club's thinking and gather everyone's views individually before he went on to manage the process with the Glazers. I spoke to Ed when I got back to Manchester and established that a final decision had been made. I knew that Ed wanted to tell David Moyes in person the following day and that we had come to the end of David's time at Old Trafford. Ryan Giggs was to step in as caretaker manager while the club considered their options. Louis van Gaal's name was soon in the frame. Louis, who took the job, is what I would call a manager's coach. He's one of these committed ultra-professionals. Football is his life. Wherever he is managed, every footballer will have learned from him. He's strong, single-minded, as he showed again with the Netherlands at the World Cup. A marvellously entertaining tournament which supported my earlier point about teams counter-attacking nowadays en masse. I like Louis, and I've always had a good rapport with him. If I had to choose one word for him, it would be formidable. His urge is to play attractive football. He likes to watch players play and players train, and to be involved at all levels, including in the development of young players. His background at Ajax shows that his faith in youth will not diminish. He was a good choice. As the big decisions began to be made, I was delighted to see Ryan Giggs appointed assistant manager, which was a terrific decision by Louis. Louis could help Giggs learn about this business. In turn, Ryan could help Louis in understanding the inner workings of United. By then, Ryan had finally lowered the curtain on his great playing career. As I look back on all those trophies and those 963 appearances and 168 goals, I recall him as a physical freak. How he could have performed at the level he played at for all those years is beyond me. With Giggs, I found perfection. Giggsy was a huge influence on the players around him, as Cantona was in his time. After a game, the team would huddle around him. Ryan was always good for advice, and he will do well under Van Gaal. The club experienced tough times last season, but the support never wavered. The fans were fantastic. I was disappointed for David Moyes, but it was always going to be difficult for whoever followed me. We look forward to progress and success under the guidance of Louis van Gaal. Looking back on my time at Old Trafford, if I think of one aspect above all, it is the great players I managed. I wish them all well as they find new lives, inside or away from the game. Manchester United will go on being a great football club, and all those whose lives the club has touched will be stronger and wiser for the experience. I know I am.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this program.